Well, the last week we began our survey of theistic traditions of Hinduism, and today we're going to carry that on with a survey of a mad romp, if you like, through Indian history again, looking at the traditions focused on Vishnu, on the Vaishnava traditions. So last week we looked at Shiva and the traditions based on Shiva, and they called, and those traditions are Shaiva traditions, and we looked at Puranic Shaivism and Tantric Shaivism and the differences between them. And we're going to look at the same kind of pattern with the Vaishnava traditions today. And we missed out the goddess, I'm afraid, but we'll look at the goddess a bit next week when we look at local Kerala traditions. Now, the late Upanishads bear witness, as I said last week, to an emerging theism. So you get the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, which we looked at in the class, and a text called the Mahanarayana Upanishad, which bear witness to the idea of a transcendent god or a lord beyond the universe who creates or emanates the universe, which is a different kind of idea to the earlier idea of an immanent or sort of monistic idea of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad and the Chandogya Upanishad. So you get this idea beginning to emerge of a theism, of a distinct deity who is the controller of the universe. Now, the Vishnu is particularly associated with this idea, and Vishnu appears in the Rig Veda, first of all, where he's a benevolent solar deity, a deity associated with the sun. And it may be, the name, it's not sure, but the name may be derived from the verbal root vish, which is to enter. So the idea of Vishnu being that one which pervades everything, the pervader. That's mere speculation, but it could be that Vishnu comes from vish. Now, in the Puranas, as we saw, which emerge quite early on, from the in the early centuries AD mainly, the Puranas, Vishnu there is represented in two ways. The early Puranas, as I said last week, were fairly eclectic, with lots of different deities represented, and the later Puranas tend to be focused on particular deities. So the Vishnu Purana you get in the Shiva Purana that we looked at briefly last week. So the Vishnu is represented in these texts in two ways. He's a dark blue youth standing upright, possessing four arms, holding these various symbols, a conch, discus, mace and lotus, as many of you will know. And his second form is lying asleep on the claws of a great cosmic snake, or Shesha, or Ananta. And this is linked to a creation story in the Puranas, where the universe is goes into a quiescent state. Vishnu is asleep on this ocean. He wakes up, and in the Puranic mythology, and if I can remember correctly, a lotus grows out of Vishnu's navel. The lotus opens, and the creator god Brahma appears, who then creates the cosmos. And then everything goes into quiescence again, and the cosmos withdraws into Vishnu, back into the lotus, and back into Vishnu's navel, and he goes to sleep again. And this is the idea that history or time, the universe, is in a various series of cycles that repeat themselves over and over again, endlessly. And this is Vishnu's play, his Leela. So the Lakshmi Tantra raises the question, why did the Lord Vishnu create the universe? And the answer it gives is for two reasons. One, because it's Vishnu's play, and the other is to liberate bound souls. So those two reasons were given in the Lakshmi Tantra. So the universe is non-teleological in the Puranic systems, in contrast to, sort of, say, Christianity, where the telos is a goal. So in the Puranas, Vishnu then is accompanied by initially two goddesses, Sri and Lakshmi, who then get fused into one goddess. And he rides on Garuda, all these different deities have mounts, and Garuda is a mythical bird, a human bird type creature that he rides upon. Now for Vaishnavas then, Vishnu is the transcendent lord dwelling in Vaikuntha, which is at the top of the cosmic egg. Last week, do you remember, we looked at Shiva, and in the Shaiva universe you've got the cosmic egg, and we have the Shiva Loka at the top of the cosmic egg. Well, for the Vaishnavas, they adopt the same model, but at the top you've got Vaikuntha instead, which is the Vishnu's heaven. So when a Maheshwara dies, do you remember what a Maheshwara was? Again, remember what a Maheshwara was? Maheshwara was a Puranic devotee of Shiva. So when a Maheshwara dies, who's a devotee of Shiva, he goes to the top of the universe and gets reborn in Shiva's loka. So similarly, for the Vaishnavas, when a Puranic Vaishnava dies, she or he gets reborn in Vaikuntha, or in one of the other heavens of Vishnu, not particularly Vaikuntha in the Puranas. So they go there at death to liberation, really, by the Lord's grace. Now, this god Vishnu is not only transcendent in these texts, but also manifest in the world, and particularly in three ways. In his 10 incarnations, which I'll be speaking of in a minute, in various icons in temples and shrines, images in temples and shrines, and within the hearts of all beings as their inner controller, this Antaryami, the inner controller of all beings. And this idea of the inner controller is a particularly Vaishnava concept. These incarnations then, you've got Vishnu manifests himself in times of darkness, when Dharma has disappeared. And there's a classic statement in the Bhagavad Gita, which I've written on the handout here. Although I am unborn and imperishable, although I am the Lord of creatures, I do resort to my nature, which is mine, and I take on birth by my own wizardry. This is Van Buitenen's translation, perhaps I should have chosen another translation. For whenever the law languishes, O Bharata, and lawlessness flourishes, I create myself. I take on existence from aeon to aeon for the rescue of the good and the destruction of evil in order to re-establish the law. So these 10 incarnations then come into the world to re-establish Dharma, and that's the function. And there's the 10 incarnations within Hindu mythology, which you probably know about, but I'll let you read about. I won't describe the mythologies of them. There's the fish, Matsya, there's Kurma, the turtle or tortoise, Raha, the boar, yeah. Narasimha, the man lion, half human, half lion. Vamana, the dwarf. Parashurama, the Rama with the axe. Rama, the king. Krishna, Buddha, and Kalki. Now, all of these have different functions and so on. And Fred Hardy makes the observation that they actually merge from animal type creatures, from fish to turtles. Are they reptiles, turtles? I don't think. That's what it is.
They're amphibians.
They're amphibians, that's right.
Yes.
Amphibians. Yeah. So from a water creature to an amphibian to a mammal to something which is half human, half lion, to a dwarf, to a violent human being, Parashurama, to a king, Rama, and then Krishna. So it's interesting. And Kalki is the incarnation who will come in the future, who is yet to come. Now, Buddha is an interesting one. He is an incarnation, according to the Puranas, to deceive the wicked and lead the demons astray. So the Buddha incarnates to deceive the wicked. Now the Vishnu Purana is an extremely interesting text in that the Lord in his supreme form is unknowable, and this unknowability of God allows non-Vaishnava deities to be incorporated into the Vaishnava pantheon, as it were, and for non-Vaishnava cults or traditions to be colonized, if you want to use that kind of language, by Vaishnava theology. And some, if not all, of the avatars may have had independent life originally. So I think you've got a picture of independent deities. Vaishnava theology develops and Vaishnava religion or tradition becomes adopted by royalty and gets royal patronage. And the Brahmins who want to perpetuate Vaishnava ideology incorporate local deities into the theology and mythology in this sort of system of Sanskritization, of Brahmanization that I've spoken of a couple of weeks ago. So the avatars may have had an independent life, but become incorporated into the pantheon, into the Vaishnava pantheon. The origins of Vaishnava traditions are very complex, and what appear to have been independent deities become fused with Vishnu. So Vasudeva, Krishna and Narayana, or more precisely Vasudeva Krishna, Krishna Gopala and Narayana, become fused with Vishnu, and they may have originally been independent gods. And Krishna is especially important, and Vaishnava traditions tend to cluster around either Vishnu or Krishna. But there are nevertheless common features between these. And Fred Hardy speaks of Krishnaism and Vishnuism as distinct kind of trajectories of tradition. Certainly the Bhagavad Gita mentions Vishnu only a couple of times, if I recall. But it's very much focused on Krishna. But there are certain common features of the tradition which I've outlined here. So the Lord is the supreme person of the Purushottama, which is a fairly new concept in the history of Indian religions. With personal qualities, saguna, rather than an abstract absolute. So Vishnu is a personal Lord with whom you can have a relationship rather than an abstract absolute, impersonal absolute. The Lord is the cause of the cosmos. He creates, maintains and destroys it, or reabsorbs it. And the Lord reveals himself through sacred scriptures, temple icons and incarnations, and in human saints, saintly people. Now Krishna is again a very interesting deity. The origins of Krishna are slightly obscure. There was, scholars seem to think that there was a deity called Vasudeva, who was the son of a king, Vasudeva, who was of the Vrishni tribe, or the Satvatas, a tribe called the Satvatas. And the Vrishnis, I'm sure some of you know more about this than I do, but the Vrishnis became fused with the Yadavas, which were the tribe of Krishna. Worship of Vasudeva is recorded quite early, from the 5th or 6th century BC, which is pretty early really, being mentioned by Panini in the Ashtadhyayi, the grammarian Panini. And he explains the word Vasudevaka as being a devotee of the god Vasudeva. So there's, that text bears witness to the worship of Vasudeva at a very early date, 5th or 6th century. There was a Greek ambassador at the court of Chandragupta Maurya in about 320 BC at Patna or Pataliputra, and he records that the people of Mathura revered Hercules, and scholars seem to think that Hercules was the Greek name for Vasudeva. And later, a couple of hundred years later, you get another Greek ambassador, Heliodorus, set on as an inscription that he erected this column with an image of Garuda on the top in honour of Vasudeva. And I think it even says that he himself was a Bhagavata, a devotee of the Lord. So that's interesting that two Greek ambassadors should bear witness to the worship of Vasudeva. Yes, Heliodorus does indeed describe himself as a Bhagavata. And there are Bhagavatas also mentioned in the Pali Canon. Now, in due course, Krishna, the deity Krishna, becomes identified with Vasudeva. And Krishna was originally probably a deified king or hero. And the historicity of Krishna is impossible to assess from the sources in which hagiography and history are inextricably bound up together. But historicity is nevertheless important for the Vaishnava tradition. And Vaishnavas believe that Krishna was indeed a historical personage. There are early references to Krishna. The Chandogya Upanishad mentions Krishna, and also, of course, in the Mahabharata, where he's the king of the Yadavas of Dvaraka. And he's also identified, in due course, he becomes identified with Krishna in the Mahabharata. So you've got lots of different traditions developing associated with worship. You've got Vishnu in the Veda. So you've got Vedic witness to Vishnu in various hymns to Vishnu as a solar deity. And then you've got various traditions of Vishnu developing, the most important of which, I think, is undoubtedly the Bhagavata tradition, who, as I've said, were in existence probably as early as certainly about 320 BC, but perhaps earlier as well. And the Bhagavad Gita is a text of the Bhagavatas, mainly of the Bhagavatas. And this was a highly successful tradition, because possibly because of its theology, which was not particularly sectarian, fairly universal. So it's had various universalizing tendencies within it, as is witnessed by the Bhagavad Gita, that became a sort of pan-Hindu text. There's another tradition called the Pancharatra, which I'll be talking about presently. And another tradition that developed called the Vaikarnasa. Now the Bhagavata tradition in probably produced various Puranas, Vaishnava Puranas, and the Vaishnava Puranas in turn influenced the Vaishnava traditions or sects or sampradayas. Possibly distinct tradition is Krishna Gopala tradition, which I'll be speaking about in a minute, which influences the Puranic tradition. And various sampradayas, perhaps the most important is the Sri Vaishnavas. Bengal Vaishnavas, Gaudiya, and other traditions, the Vallabhas, Vallabhacharyas.
Were they the Shuddha?
Oh, yeah. The Shuddha Vaishnavas.
Shuddha Vaishnavas,
yes. Yeah. So there's a whole bunch. There's several others as well. I can't remember them all, actually. And, another strong influence is Tamil devotion. And that also influences the Puranas and these later traditions as well. So you really need a three-dimensional sort of model to chart these different developments. Okay, let's have a look at the Bhagavatas then, first of all. The Bhagavatas were focused on Krishna and Vasudeva in the Mahabharata, and it absorbs the cult of Krishna as a young man. There seems to be an independent tradition of Krishna as a young man in the forests playing the flute, the typical image of Krishna that we have, which could have been an independent tradition which influences the Bhagavatas in some ways. And he's Gopala, he's the protector of cattle. And he was a tribal god of a group called the Abiras. Yes, I think that's right. Who became absorbed, along with his brother Balarama, into the main Bhagavata tradition. Now, the Bhagavad Gita, then, is a central text of the Bhagavatas, which became pan-Hindu later on. And it's very non-sect specific, so it's kind of universal and universalizing, and it has the ability to absorb within it many other traditions. And the theology was established on a broad basis and had in royal support, which is important in the development of the tradition. There are lots of narrative traditions of Krishna as a young man. And on the banks of the Yamuna. And these are borne witness to in key texts called the Harivamsha, which is like an appendix to the Mahabharata, the Vishnu Purana, the extremely important Bhagavata Purana, which is possibly one of the most popular texts in India. The Harivamsha influences the Vishnu Purana, and the Vishnu Purana influences the Bhagavata Purana. And that text itself was probably composed in the south under the influence of Tamil devotionalism. If you want to read about this, there's a good book by Frieda Matchin, actually, on the influence of these texts on each other. And it's called The Love of Krishna. I don't know if you know it. The Curzon Press, about 5 years ago. Frieda Matchin. Now, Krishna Gopala is an amorous young man wandering with his brother through the Vrindavan forest, destroying demons, dancing and making love with the cowgirls, the gopis. And this mythological basis, this is a sort of mythological basis for a later sophisticated theology which was developed particularly in Bengal Vaishnavism. And later Vaishnava poetry focuses on this eroticism of Krishna and his love of the cowgirls, especially Radha. And there's a wonderful poem by Jayadeva called the Gita Govinda, the song of the Gita Govinda in the 12th century, and poetry of Chandidas and Vidyapati in the 14th century, which bear witness to this love of Krishna, particularly with Radha. I'll be returning to that presently. Now, the other tradition, the Pancharatra, which was associated with the worship of Narayana, Pancharatra means the five nights. And it was probably the five-night sacrifice by Purusha Narayana described in the Shatapatha Brahmana. We're not sure of the origins of the term. And what's distinctive about the Pancharatra is the Vyuha doctrine, which is in one section of the Mahabharata. And this Vyuha doctrine is that the Lord, Vasudeva, or Narayana, has emanations. And these emanations each have a cosmic function, a cosmological function. So these are relatives of Krishna in the mythology, Sankarsana, Pradyumna, and Aniruddha, but they become, in the Pancharatra, emanations of Vasudeva or Narayana. And the Vyuhas, the cosmos for the Pancharatra, is made up of these different levels. So you get the pure level, the pure cosmos, which comprises the Vyuhas. And then the mixed cosmos, which is the next level down, which emanates up from the pure cosmos, and then the impure cosmos, in which the world is a part, emanates from the mixed cosmos. So you get this unfolding of the universe from what they regard as the pure abodes, pure levels, to more and more impure levels, and so you get to the world, which is the most solidified of these worlds, or this cosmic process. Now, this system was particularly developed by the Pancharatra in texts which they regarded as revelation, called the Sanhitas. So last week we looked at the Shaivas, and you had the Shaiva Tantras were a further revelation for the Shaivas. So the Sanhitas are a revelation for the Pancharatra. So that this is Tantric Vaishnavism, really. The Pancharatra Sanhitas are the Tantric Vaishnavism from about the 7th and the 8th century. And there's one text, actually, that we're reading in class, the Jayakya, which is particularly important, which tells about the unfolding of the cosmos in this system, the Vyuhas, who then emanate the lower creation, and then the mixed and the impure. And the lower creation comprises the tattvas that we looked at last week in the Vaishnava, in the Shaiva systems. Sorry, this is completely confusing for everyone. I hope it's not. No. So you've got Pancharatra, which is like tantric Vaishnavism, which parallels tantric Shaivism. And then you've got the Bhagavata tradition, which is a Puranic worship of Shiva and Vishnu, paralleling the Maheshwara's worship of Shiva that we looked at last week. Now, the Bhagavatas, it's not quite as clear cut as that, and there's some overlap between the Bhagavatas and the Pancharatra. And certainly one of the most important Vaishnava theologians, Ramanuja, revered the Pancharatra Samhitas and Revelation. And there was a big debate about it, whether these were in fact Revelation or not. And Yamuna, Ramanuja's grand teacher, I think, wrote a book supporting the idea that the Pancharatra texts were in fact Revelation. But distinguishing the Pancharatra Samhitas from their cousins, the Shaiva texts, the Shaiva Tantras. Although actually the content is very similar. So the Jayakya is the locus classicus for the ritual identification of the body with the universe. And although it's a Vaishnava text, it actually influences the Shaiva, later Shaiva traditions as well. And in fact, there's a Shaiva Utpaladeva quotes the Jayakya Samhita in his work. So these are the three jewels, the Paushkara, the Jayakya, and the Ahirbudniya, the serpent of the depths. And also the Lakshmi Tantra, the later Lakshmi Tantra, which is largely based on the Jayakya. Now these texts of the Pancharatra, they're much more sort of sectarian, if you like, than the Bhagavata tradition, which tends to have these universalizing tendencies. So you have to be initiated into it. There's this elaborate cosmology and a practice that you do for the rest of your life, having been initiated, which involves the ritual identification of the body, the purification of the body, the Bhuta Shuddhi, followed by the which is the symbolic destruction of the body. I may have spoken about this last week. So in the Jayakya describes the body pervaded by the levels of the universe, and then in your ritual imagination you destroy the body from the soles of the feet upwards, so that the body is burned like from a fire coming from the big toe of the left foot, I think. And then the body is, in your imagination, a pile of ashes, which is then swept away by your mantra, by the floods of water pouring out from your mantra recitation. And then having destroyed the body, you recreate a new body through nyasa, through the imposition of mantras upon the body. You touch different parts of the body and recite mantras, thereby divinizing it. And then you're fit to worship, having become a god, you can then worship Narayana internally in your heart. So you imagine Narayana coming down through the top of your aperture and residing in your heart, in a throne in your heart, which you've created in your imagination. And there you offer incense and flowers and food to Narayana in your heart. And then having done that, you perform external worship to an icon of Narayana outside of yourself. And you do that, and then at death you gain liberation. You become absorbed into Narayana or Vasudeva. It uses both words. Another tradition, the Vaikarnasas, are an orthodox Vedic Vaishnava tradition. And there's some connection with the Pancharatra, but the tradition insists that it's Vaidika, it's not Tantrika, it's a Vaidika tradition. And the focus here is the worship of Vishnu as a royal guest. And at death, again, you go into Vishnu's heaven, having worshipped him and been devoted to him through your life. At death, you enter Vishnu's heaven. And the function of the Vaikarnasas, the Vaikarnasas function as priests in many South Indian temples even today. There's a Tirupati temple, I think, in Andhra Pradesh, where they're particularly important.
I think the Bhattacharyas.
Right. Right.
Are they the, I mean, I'm just asking, are they the Bhattacharyas of the Vaishnava temple?
I don't know actually. I'm sorry, they could have, they could well be.
I don't remember.
But certainly the Vaikarnas, it's still a thriving tradition, although it's been eroded in the last centuries, you know. Now, Gerard Kola, who studied the Vaikarnas, says that actually they're a tantric tradition, because they have there are two tantric Vaishnava traditions, the Pancharatra and the Vaikarnasa. But the Vaikarnasa, it seems to me, do actually want to distinguish themselves from the Pancharatra through claiming that they're Vaidika and not tantrika. So they're pure Vaishnava followers, not impure tantric followers. But certainly there's an ambiguity about these texts, and there's ambivalent feelings towards the Pancharatra Samhitas. I mean, although Ramanuja technically accepts the Pancharatra Samhitas, he never writes about them. So there's no commentaries or anything on these texts. Okay, so you've got these traditions that develop, but by Vaikarnasa orthodox worship of Vishnu, the Bhagavata tradition, which feeds into the Puranas, and the Puranic orthodox Puranic worship of Vishnu, and the Pancharatra, which is tantric worship of Vishnu, which nevertheless influences the Puranic traditions. Feeding into the Puranic tradition, you've got the Krishna Gopala tradition, the erotic young man in Vrindavan. And then you've also got added to this mix the Tamil devotionalism, the South Indian devotionalism, which influences the Bhagavata Purana, and also the later sampradayas, the later traditions as well. Now, this Tamil devotion is particularly important and adds real sort of fire to the Vaishnava tradition. In the early centuries AD, you had two traditions of poetry in the south. One was called interior poetry and one was exterior poetry, Akamipuram. Exterior being war and interior being love. And these two forms of poetry become very influential on later Vaishnava poetry. And there was a group called the Alvars, those who were immersed in God, who sung poems, sung their songs, composed songs to Vishnu, and sung their songs to different Vaishnava deities in the temples in the south of India. And their texts become absorbed into the what's called the Tamil Veda. So in front of you, there's on that extra handout, if I can find it, you've got some poetry from the Tamil Veda, from the translated by Carmen and Narayana, Vasu Narayana. So I don't know Tamil, so I have no access to the originals here, but this is the kind of flavour of this material. Pull out by the roots thoughts of you and yours. Reach God, there is nothing more right in your life. Move to his side, your bondage will loosen. At the time your body falls, think of him. He has 1,000 names, the wondrous one who abides in Anantapuram, where flowers bloom in gardens and terraces loom like mountains. If you will go, no sins will stick to you. Each name is like 1,000. Say it, and this is then a celestial city. So that's another important dimension here. The actual physical space of the temple in South India is the celestial city, is heaven. Vishnu isn't anywhere else but there in the temple before you. There is none equal, none superior to the Lord. My tongue sings only his song. My limbs dance in ecstasy. My limbs dance in ecstasy and bow before him. Dancing, dancing, her body wilting, singing, singing, eyes pouring tears, ever seeking, crying, Narasingha is my girl with a glowing forehead. So the glowing forehead is possibly a reference to elephants whose foreheads glow when they're in a state of amorous excitement. Um, again, the Lord has not a touch of sorrow. He is auspicious and exceedingly radiant. Because of the love born of his constant union with Sri, he is exceedingly tender and beautiful and possesses other fully auspicious qualities. He is excited. Because of this union, he possesses unsurpassed divine knowledge. So very interesting in this tradition. You get love and knowledge linked together. Love is a form of knowledge. With this knowledge and Sri, he creates the world as his sport. After clasping the auspicious feet of this wondrous lord of the beautiful Dvaraka, all my sorrows were expelled. It's rather nice, it's rather rich that. So you've got the idea of love and knowledge, or if you translate jnana as cognition, love is a kind of cognition, is a kind of perception. And again at 6, his essential nature consists of wisdom, bliss and purity. He is opposed to all filth and possesses unlimited glorious attributes. His pastime is the sport of creating, protecting and destroying the world. So that's Vishnu's activity, his leela. He is the soul of the entire universe. His body is the entire universe. He who is without karma has as his body all souls and matter and is their soul. He is pure, not affected by the happiness, sorrow, change, and the imperfection of all other things. This is the Supreme Person. So that's a very very fine summary of Vaishnava theology, of particularly of Ramanuja. So the Lord has its essential nature, which is wisdom, bliss, and purity, but he's also got attributes. So he is... in his essence, he is unknowable, really. In his essence, he's unknowable. Then in his attributes, in his vibhuti, or his powers, he is knowable. So Ramanuja makes a distinction between the svarupa of Vishnu, the essence of Vishnu, and his vibhuti, his powers. And you can know the powers, the vibhuti, but you can't know the svarupa, because the svarupa is wholly outside of human knowledge. And then you've got the idea of the universe as God's body, which is a very important theme in the Ramanuja. And the Lord is without karma, of course. Although he has a body, he has no got no karma. And is completely detached, unaffected by happiness, sorrow, change, and the imperfections of the changing world. So just going to number 10, Nasi. It's another sort of typical flavour of this poetry. I adore at your feet, call you with cringing heart, like a dog wagging its short tail. O you who held aloft the mountain and protected the cattle from rain, I am distressed without your grace. So this is a Tamil translation from the Tamil poetry, which is not dissimilar from poetry later in northern traditions, particularly in Bengal. Now these sampradayas that develop in the early centuries AD, a sampradaya is a tradition focused on a deity. It's often regional, into which a disciple is initiated by a guru, and each guru is in a lineage, and this is particularly important in a parampara or santana, a lineage passed from teacher to a disciple. And a sampradaya, within a sampradaya, a disciple undertakes to abide by the rules of the tradition, takes on a new name and a mantra, which they repeat. And Vaishnava sampradayas located themselves within an orthodox context, within a Vedika context, particularly of smarta worship. Now there are four traditions, particularly based on the teachings of Ramanuja, Madhva, Vallabha and Nimbarka, that develop. But the historical actuality is more complex than these four traditions, and there were others, and they influence each other. So particularly important are the Sri Vaishnavas in Tamil Nadu, whose centre is at Sri Rangam, and they adopt the theology of Ramanuja. The Gaudiya Vaishnavas, or Bengal Vaishnavas, located mainly in Bengal, Orissa and Vrindavan, and they revere the teachings of the Bengali saint Chaitanya, whose dates are approximately 1486 to 1533. a focus on devotion to Krishna and Radha. And in one, some forms of the tradition, Chaitanya himself is an incarnation of Krishna and Radha in one form, in one body. There's the cult of Vithoba in Maharashtra, and the pilgrimage centre of Pandharpur, and that's based on the teachings of Gyaneshvara and Namdev and other saints. I'll be talking about the saints in a minute. They're a very interesting group. There's the cult of Rama in the northeast of Ayodhya, particularly focused on Ram Leela, on the festival of Ram Leela, where the Ramayana is performed. So you've got those main traditions, the Vaishnava traditions, if you like, which have mutual influence on each other. And you've got also a northern Sant tradition, which isn't strictly Vaishnava, but nevertheless is strongly influenced by Vaishnavism, which worships the transcendent Lord without qualities. So Kabir, Nanak, Namdev, Mirabai, many saints in the late medieval period, they're called saint. Saint means good person. It's like the English saint, although it's not actually related to English word saint. It's come from sat, a good person. So the saints are the good, holy people who know of God, who is nirguna, who is without qualities. So as opposed to the Vaishnava sampradayas, which worship the Saguna Lord, the Lord with qualities, the saints worship this nirguna deity. And the saint tradition develops into Sikhism. So Sikhism comes out of the saint tradition, originated with Nanak. But the emphasis of these traditions is on repeating the names of God and merging with the Lord, who is nirgun, who is without qualities. And Radha Swami tradition in contemporary Punjab is an inheritor of this tradition, which is a kind of fusion of Vaishnava and Sikh elements, if you like. Now, theologically, these traditions are quite interesting. I just mentioned the cat and monkey schools. In Sri Vaishnavism, after a couple of hundred years after Ramanujan's death, there was a split in the community between what's called the northern culture and the southern culture. And this was not only a split of culture, but also a split of theology. The north emphasized Sanskrit, Sanskritic learning, and traditional bhakti, and the south emphasized Tamil and surrender to the Lord by his grace. And they became known as the monkey and the cat schools, respectively. So the monkey school was that you're saved through some effort, but through the grace of the Lord. As a baby monkey clings to its mother as she goes through the trees, so the soul clings to Vishnu, it clings to the Lord. But he is the one. You have to do some of the work through clinging on, but Vishnu saves you in the end. And the cat school was pure grace, which is as a mother cat picks up her kittens and transports them to a different place, so Vishnu takes hold of his souls, the souls of his devotees, and takes them to liberation. So the soul there is passive, there's no effort involved. And a lot of this becomes focused on a verse from the Gita 1862 called the Charma Shloka. Abandoning all laws, seek shelter in me alone. I will save you from all sins. Do not fear. Now, the northern culture interpreted this to mean that there were two paths, traditional bhakti yoga and a superior path of surrender, prapati, to the Lord. So traditional bhakti, you know, doing puja and all that, or utter emotional surrender, as it were, to the Lord, who saves you by his grace. That was the northern... That's the southern interpretation. The northern interpretation says that actually the verse refers to two groups of people, not two emotional attitudes, if you like. Those who are twice born and liberated through the performance of ritual devotion, and those of lower caste who can't perform ritual in temples and so are liberated through surrender. And that's Vedanta Deshika's understanding. So there's different interpretations of that Charma Shloka. There's an interesting article on this by Patricia Mum in a book called Texts in Context, edited by Jeffrey Timms, T-I-M-M-S. So that I think that reflects a real tension in theistic traditions between grace and effort, and exemplified particularly here in the Vaishnava tradition. Are you saved through your own efforts? Well, you're always saved through grace, but to what extent are you saved through grace, and to what extent are you saved through effort? Another interesting theological debate is the relationship between pure love and desire. Now, in the Bengal Vaishnava tradition, you get this poetry. Sorry, let's go back a bit. In Kavya, in poetic literature, Sanskrit poetry, there's this trope or this theme of love in separation and love in union. Love in separation is identified with parakia, another's wife, with adulterous love, which is characterized by longing, and which is, you know, goes against all the usual dharmic understandings. And svakya means one's own wife, which is love in union, which is characterized by desire or lust, karma. And in this poetry, the poetry of longing has a higher kind of aesthetic quality than union and the satisfaction of desire, as it were. Now, this gets adapted in the Vaishnava theology, where longing becomes a higher state. And Fred Hard has written an interesting book, Viraha Bhakti. So longing, viraha, and separation becomes a higher state than lust and union, as it were. So this is exemplified by the love of Radha and Krishna. Although they're together in the forest at night, and Radha leaves a shadow or an image of herself with her husband to be with Krishna in the forest at night, she knows the dawn is coming and must return to her daily duties, to her Stri Dharma, her Dharma as a woman. And pure love, prema, becomes identified with the sort of erotic love, Shringara or Madhura Bhakti, in the later Vaishnava tradition. So the love between Radha and Krishna is prema, and is viraha, is longing. And that relationship indicates the eternal separation of them, and yet they're also their intimate union. This relationship is between Shaktimat, the possessor of power, and Shakti, Radha, as his power, as the power of the Lord. And the relationship between Krishna and Radha exemplifies the relationship between the devotee and the Lord, which is one of, although they're separate, they're also intimately connected as one, as lovers are connected. So, and this is Achintya Beda Beda, the inconceivable, Achintya, unthinkable, that which cannot be conceptualized. Relationship of difference in identity. Although they're different, they're actually bound up together intimately. And that's an extremely important theme in the history of Vaishnava traditions. I was going to go on to talk about Ramanuja, but I think I'll end it there. Any questions or points? Or objections, or.
Well, you were saying that the universe is not teleological, it's leave of, and then it's also sort of reformation for the souls, but isn't that reformation for the soul?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's purposive. It has no beginning and end, I think that's probably what I meant. So the why does God create the universe? And the two answers are for Leela, because it's play. I think there's even the image of the children building something of sand. I can't remember. And the other...
They're only ensnared by the creation in the first place, so that they have to be liberated, so it's still not good. that sense.
Yeah, that's right. They're ensnared. If they, if yes,
if
that's right.
No creation, then they wouldn't need to be liberated.
Yes, that's right. if they weren't ensnared, there wouldn't have to be liberation in a sense. Yeah, but it is teleological in a sense. You could be liberated, I could be liberated, but the cosmos itself carries on through these cycles.
You mentioned that in the Gita there is hardly ever mention of Vishnu.
I think it occurs about twice, I think.
Twice. Maybe in the Gita, but in the Mahabharata itself, it is Bhishma who's given the composition of the Sahasra. Vishnu Sahasranama was composed by, supposed to have been credited to Vishnu, which is 1,001 names for Vishnu.
That's right, yes. Yeah. Mahabharata, very important in
As Vishnu, because Bhishma recognizes who Krishna is quite clearly.
So this is an argument. Some people think that the Gita was actually composed outside of that text and was incorporated into it. I don't have an opinion about that.
And now I remember why the name Vaikhanasa, when Bhattacharya comes in, we had to consult those for the Shastras in how to renovate a Vaishnava temple.
Oh, did you?
Yes, we had to consult those who were of that group.
Oh, right.
Because
right.
They were the ones who told us which is the right way to do it.
Sure.
If they didn't approve, we couldn't sanctify it.
That's very high status.
Very high status, and they know all the rules. And
yes, that's right. That's right.
All the Shastras, Agama Shastra, Shilpa Shastras, everything.
Right. It's amazing. So they're still carrying on this tradition.
Oh, yes.
Still,
we had to consult them to get the approval.
Right, right. I don't know how many people there are within those traditions still, but they're very important.
In this poem, this hymn, as I understood it from the Alvars, so they are mostly worshipping Vishnu, isn't it?
Yes.
And focusing. But isn't it, I found it interesting, the last verse hinting towards Krishna, and what is the relationship?
Well, that's right, yes.
Towards,
yes, that's right. You held aloft the mountain, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. You know, I don't know the answer to that. Krishna is generally, origin is in the north, but at what point did Krishna sort of penetrate the south? I don't know, I'm afraid. You'll have to check it out.
Is this from Namarvas?
Yes, this is from the Tamil Veda, translated by Karaman and Narayana. Yeah. So this is incorporated. So you've got this is the high regard that these poets had. They were so sacred, according to the southern Vaishnavas, that they were like the Veda, this revelation. So I hope you can see parallel developments here with the Shaivism as well that we looked at last week. So you get similar patterns developing. The Vaishnavas tend to be closer to the Vedic tradition than the Shaivas. The Shaivas are much more willing to go away from the Vedic tradition, as we saw. And there's some dispute as to who had most important royal patronage. So there were rituals for conversion to Shaivism, but there weren't rituals, as far as I know, for conversion to Vaishnavism. That's in the early medieval period. But Vaishnavism has this tendency to be very broad and to incorporate, to embrace all, to bring everybody within it in a way that some of the traditions didn't. Although there are some Vaishnava traditions which weren't like that. So the Pancharatri, you were branded as a Pancharatri. So you have, in your initiation, you have a brand that was put on your shoulder. So it's a textualization of the body there. So next week we'll look at Kerala traditions, and we'll look